Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning and welcome to Speak Up. It is Monday, May 29th. My name is Magnus Tiewald and I'm your host for today's Speak Up. And joining me today is Ayu Sakamoto. Hello.
Hello.
Ayu is one of our new members of the spoken word team here at CJSF. And you're going to be hearing more from her over the coming months as she starts getting into creating content and interviews and other things to contribute to our programs here. We're going to talk a little more with Ayu in a little bit, but first we're going to run our first feature interview of the day. The city of Burnaby has initiated a project to issue an apology to its Chinese-Canadian community. Through much of the early part of the last century, as was happening both at the federal and provincial level, the municipal government was busy enacting many laws and policies and practices that were quite and directly discriminatory to the Chinese community of Burnaby. And now the city of Burnaby is launching a project to research that history and engage with the community, leading to ultimately to an apology. I had an opportunity to speak to Councillor Richard Lee and Lisa Codd, of a staff person at the City of Burnaby and the person who's leading the project for the city, about the apology last week. So here's our chat. Joining me today is Richard Lee, councillor for the City of Burnaby, and Lisa Codd, who's part of Burnaby staff. And we're here to talk about a project the city is undertaking to issue an apology to its Chinese-Canadian community over past policies and laws that the city of Burnaby enacted in the past century that were quite discriminatory. Perhaps we can start up, you can tell me what was the genesis of this project and why now?
All right. Thank you for the opportunity to answer that question. The city for quite a number of years now, starting mainly around 2017, has been actively researching Chinese-Canadian history in Burnaby and sharing that information with the public. And part of that research surfaced past discriminatory policies and practices of our local government in Burnaby. And as a result, a community group, the Burnaby Intercultural Planning Table, in cooperation with the Coalition Against Racism, contacted our municipal council and suggested that we undertake a process like this. Council was very supportive of that suggestion, and so we're proceeding.
Right. So the whole project is about more than just an apology. There's an effort to do research and compile the history of these policies and but also to engage the community in the discussion. Can you tell me more about that?
Yeah, I think it's important when you're apologizing to someone that you are also connecting to ensure that that apology is meaningful and that actions are taken in support of the apology. Similar apology processes at the City of Vancouver and New Westminster as well have included community engagement work to consult with the community, raise awareness of the issues, and also to identify legacy actions such as commemoration project that can support ongoing engagement with the community.
So what kind of policies, what kind of things have been discovered through this process? I've heard about some of them and they're kind of eye-opening in some cases.
Yeah, and there's still research to do. I think we're in our preliminary stage with our research, but there's a number of ways that as a local government, Burnaby discriminated against people of Asian descent. So some of those included joining advocacy efforts of other municipalities to try to exclude Asian immigration, for example. And some of those other actions targeted Chinese businesses. So bylaws that restricted trade licenses for greengrocers and piggery operators, which were a couple of the common businesses that Chinese Canadians had in the early part of the 20th century. And we also are the fourth bylaw. So this was a priority of Burnaby's early municipal council. The fourth bylaw enacted by Burnaby restricted employment of Asian Canadians by the local government or by anyone contracting services to the local government. And that bylaw remained in effect until 1953.
Yeah, I read another story about a bylaw that was proposed by a Vancouver-based chapter of the KKK and then adopted, well, maybe not a bylaw, but a policy adopted by Burnaby and I presume other municipalities in the area.
Yeah, so sometimes groups like the KKK advocated for discriminatory policies, and they would write to various levels of government and ask them to endorse their efforts. And yeah, our council did endorse those efforts. If I'm remembering them right, that was an effort to exclude Asian immigration.
It's interesting because we've heard a lot over the number of years about the policies put forth at the national and the provincial level. It's really interesting to see these similar things having happened at the municipal level. I guess in many ways, it's not really surprising, but it really is interesting to see what was going on. And I think one of the things about municipal governments that they have, in many cases, so many more points of contact with their citizens on even a daily basis that these kind of policies put in at the municipal level can be, in many ways, more impactful.
Yeah, and I'm sure that Councillor Lee could definitely speak to sort of the layers of discrimination by all levels of government that took place in the past.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. As you know, and many people know, that the federal government actually had the Chinese Exclusion Act in that level. So from early, probably 1885 to 1923, the Hack Tax was imposed to the Chinese community at that time. And actually, my grandfather paid for the Hack Tax in 1913 to get into Canada as a farmer. So at that time, the Hack Tax was imposed starting from $50 and increasingly quickly increased to $100 and then went up to $500. I heard that at that time, $500, you can buy two building lots in Chinatown, Vancouver. Yeah. So that's a lot of money to pay back. So I think over the years, this kind of discriminatory policy had been redressed in the federal level in the 2007, and then provincially, we also did a recognition 2013-14 in that period, so that those discriminatory laws in the province level, we take out quite a few of those injustice law in the legislature in DC, and then redress that. We also just heard that, Vancouver, of course, had redressed that, and New West did that as well. So I think this is a time between Vancouver and New West, Burnaby, we are going to do something on that front. So I'm very pleased to hear that. This is one page of the dark history in Canadian history. We would like to see what kind of laws and bylaws in the city level that have been passed or implemented. So I think this is a good way. As 100 years of the Chinese Exclusion Act, because after 1923, the city, the whole country actually implemented that federal law to ban actually immigration for the ordinary Chinese to come to Canada. So to 1923 until 1947, after the Second World War, that because of the Chinese veterans, their contribution to defending Canada's value, as well as went to the war for Canada, that the Canadian government actually saying that now you can vote, you can have Canadian citizenship, that kind of thing. So I think for 100 years, I think this is a day that we should commemorate and see that those unjust, these discriminatory laws won't see their lights again in the future.
So, I mean, what does it feel like to you personally as a member of the Chinese community to learn about these kind of policies enacted by the city you now represent on council?
Yeah, the KKK resolution passed by the council, endorsement by the council at that time. That was the first, I mean, I just heard about that a few months ago. So those are new to me. And I think some of those histories we need to learn more as a community to see what kind of actually bylaws will pass as a city. So I think it would be interesting that our next generation will learn about the history and also the community itself. We see that now we are really fortunate to live in a harmonious society. We should treasure our position, our daily life, and also the rights and freedom in this good Canadian society.
Have you heard from members of the community in response to this initiative?
It's from the newspaper, the Chinese Canadian newspaper. They also publish news about this initiative from Burnaby. They are very supportive. I believe also there are some people who would like to be sitting in the committee as well to see how they can contribute to this process. We learned that Burnaby also will be publishing a book about Chinese Canadians in the city, and the community is really positive on seeing the result of that book, the contents, etc. So I think thanks to the city staff and the council, and they look into this issue and very supportive of these initiatives.
In many ways, all these bylaws and policies and regulations enacted by the city and the other level governments must have really only been, in many ways, the tip of the iceberg, because when all the levels of government are putting in these kinds of policies and whatnot, that must really have emboldened individuals and even, you know, people working for the city to express and act on their racist attitudes. So, you know, you mentioned it, a dark period in history. You know, it spreads out and becomes bigger than just a matter of
of policy and bylaw. So what's the timeline for the completion of the project?
We will be, going out to consult with the community in the fall and also in 2024, and we're expecting the formal apology in 2025. It's important to take the time to do the consultation and that engagement with the community. And some of this information is a surprise to members of the community. So I think we need to take the time to be able to get the word out about what happened and what is happening.
When it is offered, what will the apology look like? Will there be a public ceremony, or has that been determined yet?
That is something we'll work with the community on. I think every community will have its own desire of what they want that apology to look like in terms of the level of formality, the languages that it needs to be delivered in, the place where it might be delivered in. So there's still a lot that we want to work out, but we want to make sure that we're engaging with the community to make those decisions.
And will there be any lasting legacy or a public display or memorial?
So that also is something that will come out of the consultation to find out what those legacy projects might look like. Although, I mean, the city, as Councillor Lee mentioned, has taken on a number of projects to commemorate Chinese Canadian history in Burnaby, including a book that will be published later this year. And I think it's just important to remember that though we're talking about this incredible web of racism and discriminatory policies from all levels of government, including several local governments, that there's also these stories of incredible resilience of the Chinese Canadian community members. So we want to make sure we're also telling those stories of resilience and the way that community members contributed. And in Burnaby, a lot of that contribution was growing food. Chinese Canadian farmers grew, despite restrictions on land ownership, were able to farm an incredible amount of food that fed the region. Actually, yeah, and Councillor Lee's family was a farm family as well.
Yeah, actually the Leung's family, they still operate in the South Burnaby. The Leung's family, they had a market garden in the Musqueam land, reserve land near Dunbar and Marine Drive. My grandfather actually farmed in that Musqueam reserve land for almost 30 years as a partner in a market garden, and so they leased the land from the First Nations and with a partner. And one time there are over, I think, 20 market gardeners in that area. So I heard many stories about the market gardeners. Larry Grant, senior elder in that community, told me a lot of stories, and including he was playing in the Hong Kong Garden, Market Garden, and then that's an interaction with my grandfather. So I think that's some of the stories to tell. Yeah.
Well, thank you for joining me today. I think this is a really important project, and as we've seen from what has come forth so far, there's a lot of stuff that people did not know about, and it's important to shine a light on those things, and it's really great to see Burnaby doing this. Thank you for joining me today, Lisa Codd with the City of Vancouver, and Richard Lee, Councillor, with the City of Burnaby.
All right. Thank Lisa you. Codd,
and Richard Lee, Councillor with the City of Burnaby, both with the City of Burnaby. Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, pleasure talking to you.
And the City of Burnaby will be continuing this project with a goal of completing in 2025. So there's a lot of work to happen yet. You can find out more about the Apology Project on the City of Burnaby website. And, of course, keep your eye out for public notices and advertisements about their engagement process, which will be happening over the next year or so. All right. Ayu is here in the studio with me today, and she's going to be getting started on doing some contributions to this program and the other Speak Ups in the morning. What are your interests in the things you're interested in covering, Ayu?
So I'm interested in some culture things. So I'm from Japan, so I want to introduce some Japanese culture, and also I'm interested in foreign cultures.
Yeah, nice. Yeah, we just had a little while ago, we had the Cherry Blossom Festival here in Vancouver.
Yeah.
Did you go to any of those events?
I didn't go because I just I temporarily returned to Japan at that time.
So you'll be maybe telling us about some Japanese artists and musicians and whatnot that you're aware of, and yeah.
Yes.
Who's your right now? Who's your favorite Japanese artist of any kind?
I like. She's already passed out, but I like Zard.
Yeah.
Is
she a musician or?
Musician. And yeah. She wrote lyrics mm-hmm. by herself.
Yeah.
And her song is really good.
Oh, nice. Yeah. I'm sorry we don't have that with us today, but next time you're on, maybe we'll do a little, we'll see if we can't track down a track and do a little something on it.
Yeah.
Let's take a quick look at the weather here in Vancouver the next week. It's going to be a pretty nice week. A bit of sun and cloud today, improving to sun and light cloud, and then a few days of sun. Not too excessively hot. We're going to have highs up to 18 or 19 degrees through the early part of the week, climbing a bit to 21 or 22 degrees later in the week with a bit of mix of sun and cloud. So a pretty mellow week. Good enough to get to the beach. Great to go out hiking or spend an evening in the park. That's what you can look forward to this week. Another thing you can look forward to this week is, starting on Thursday, is the Music Waste Festival. This is a festival that happens every year and has been going for, I'd have to look it up again, but a long time, at least 20 years, probably more. We're going to play a little documentary that will delve into the history, so I won't get into that. But the Music Waste Festival starts this Thursday and runs through Sunday all weekend at various locations in East Vancouver. And we'll talk a bit more specifically about what you can expect from the festival next week. But first off, here's a documentary produced by Jamie Sethford about the Music Waste story.
When we think of music festivals today, we still find ourselves married to this image of Woodstock. We have open fields, big stages, thousands of people probably suffering from questionable hygienic choices, and lots of booze and drugs. And to be honest, not much has changed. If anything, the idea of a music festival has been streamlined into a rite of passage for young adults. Coachella, into Sasquatch, into Sled Island, into Pemberton, there's just so many choices. And they're all big productions and, frankly, aren't very cheap. But sometimes, you don't need to spend hundreds of dollars or travel hours away to see great music or party hard. Of course, if you're from Vancouver, you probably already know this. Because you have Music Waste. Every June, for 4 days and $15, all you need to do is hop on your bike and bounce around from venue to venue. That's it. That's Music Waste. And for Vancouver's music community, it's kind of become this unofficial kickoff to summer. But there's a lot more to it than that. Music Waste comes from a true anti-establishment sentiment, born out of a sarcastic discontent with corporate music and their sponsors. There's a spirit to this festival that's rooted in history and has allowed for it to survive for 20-plus years, outliving many of the big-box competitors that it was created to protest against.
For me, I think Music Waste is this space that is very unique to Vancouver.
This is Eleanor Waring. She's a coordinator for Music Waste.
Because the festival doesn't take itself too seriously and because it's kind of volunteer run and most of the bands are really relaxed that are playing it as well, when stuff does go wrong or something happens with a venue or something has to shift, everybody kind of really has this can-do attitude where they're like, yep, okay, we're just gonna, that doesn't work, so we're gonna see what are our other options, like who can I call in for favors, like, and because everybody loves Music Waste, they're often very willing to help and to kind of overcome those hurdles.
And that's the big takeaway from Music Waste, the message from the community to itself. Don't take yourself too seriously. Now, when the original started in 1994, this was the idea. It was to push back against a festival that did take itself far too seriously and forced people to kind of bump elbows and pay to play. Initially, it was a one-off, but then it started to grow. After a couple years of hiatus, this festival was revisited again in the new millennium. This is Dustin Bromley. He used to be a coordinator for Music Waste.
So as I understand it, there was New Music West, which was, very, let's say, corporation-funded, and, you know, there's a lot of your Nickelback-style bands, your radio rock bands, and apparently their selection process was a little more, elite, or they were definitely going after a certain sound, very, very just, like, easy on the ears, and these bands, as it's been told, we're doing things that have been done, you know, thousands of times before. Cool. And a group of people started a one-day festival called Music Waste, which, as I mentioned, is a big, big middle finger to the sky to New Music West. And in subsequent years, it expanded to a multiple day festival.
But it really wasn't until the revival in 2004 that Music Waste became the festival that we would recognize it as today. This is Sarah Cordingley. She's one of the people that was around Music Waste at the time of its rebirth.
I was an intern at the Terminal City Weekly magazine, and some of the people there, in particular, John Cow, who was the music editor at the Terminal City at the time, and Darren Atwater, who was the editor, they sort of remembered or thought back nostalgically about Music Waste and thought they should resurrect it, and they... I believe they actually talked to Chris Wood, who was one of the original organizers. They bought it from him for $50 or something, or maybe even less, and they sort of took it over. And the first year was really successful and really fun, and to me, really sort of embodied exactly what it was meant to be, where it was sort of just chaos and everyone was just organizing it out of the good of their hearts and no one was really making any money.
While New Music West no longer existed, the ideals did. The idea that networking, self-promotion, and presentation were more important than the artistry behind the music was and still is a point of frustration within the Vancouver scene. During her time at Terminal City and then Only Magazine, Sarah and her team actively tried to disrupt superficiality through Music Waste and its promotion.
We often wrote sort of silly reviews of the bands that were, again, meant to just not take it too seriously. And who wants to read, you know, 85 band descriptions that are all just like talking about how great they are and how they're the next so-and-so, or, you know, how they're breaking boundaries and coming up with a new sound. It just seemed more fun to kind of make up funny stuff or tell, you know, funny stories that we knew about them. We were just so sick of bands trying to sell themselves to us, I guess.
Now, the festival's approach to actively pushing back against industry norms wasn't necessarily shared across the local scene. Bands trying to propel themselves beyond Vancouver work hard to cultivate image and press kits and didn't appreciate being called out for it.
Some of them were offensive, actually, I should say, in retrospect, that some of them were really too far and were just like vulgar and awful and rude. And some of them were maybe too true and were sort of actually poking fun at people. Something weird happened that was sort of a protest to Music Waste. And I think what happened was, this must have been in 2005 or 2006, and it was at the Columbia or Mike's Tavern. but the band, the Book of Lists, were boycotting, and then for some reason at the last minute, they decided to just like hijack a show and play. So we just like got a bunch of texts that that they were setting up at the show, and I don't know, maybe they were friends with the other bands that were playing, but they like set up and played a short set, and Cam and I like biked down there as quick as we could to watch them, and it was like kind of great because it was, you know, they were sort of mad at us, or they were sort of doing it as a protest or something, but we thought it was really great, and it was really kind of fun to have a surprise, or to have, you know, a show sort of be sabotaged in a way that resulted in people getting to see a great band.
But this don't take yourself too seriously attitude fueled the largest criticism of the festival: artistic elitism,
antagonism sort of between some bands or some artists and what they perceive as like some sort of snobby or elite group of people who are putting this on. But I think that's just based on a misconception that these people are being snobby or elitist, because they do have to choose a limited number of bands.
There are times that we have to make a decision and say, okay, no, this band has played quite a few years in a row, and we should give that spot to a new up-and-coming act. In the most part, I find that in the general spirit of the festival, bands are very supportive and kind of manage that themselves even.
Although Music Waste does frequently see many of the same faces, the turnover is fairly regular. During his tenure on the committee, Mark Richardson was tasked with scheduling the festival and recognized the emergence of new, younger acts.
Because Music Waste, they take a lot of chances on newer bands and younger bands. There's obviously a lot of familiar faces that you'll see from years past, but there's always try to make sure that there are new younger bands being selected each year, and that draws in their fan base or their friends. So I think if you do that year after year, you're just going to keep drawing in new people.
There was not enough infrastructure for emerging and weird local bands to sort of showcase themselves in a sustainable way. And I think that the more you support musicians, the more musicians support you. And historically, we've tried to be as inclusive as possible and allow people to have Music Waste shows, like to put on their own shows if they can find a venue and make it happen if they didn't get in. And we tried to support them with as much promotion as possible if they were willing to accept passes.
In making music more available and more accessible, Music Waste has opened the door to the community and has allowed artistic integrity to remain at the forefront of the scene rather than who you know or how much money you have.
Music Waste has consistently been very inexpensive, so the passes are $15, and that, if you think about the fact that in the past 20 years, like, everything has gotten more expensive in the world, the fact that it has remained this low price is incredibly remarkable. It's really important to everybody to keep it inexpensive, so I don't see that changing anytime soon, or at all. I don't see that changing ever. Actually, I think Music Waste would probably stop existing before it got more expensive.
This is the commitment Music Waste has made to Vancouver. But like, whatever. Music provided by Future Star, Devours, and Pavel. You can find them and a whole bunch of other bands from Vancouver on Bandcamp. Thanks to CJSF 90.1 FM, and special thanks to Eleanor Waring, Dustin Bromley, Mark Richardson, and Sarah Cordingley. I'm Jamie Sesford. Thanks for listening.
Thanks to Jamie Sesford for that documentary. That's from a few years ago. So, you know, the people, there's a new group of folks carrying on the legacy of Music Waste these days. It is coming up Thursday, Friday, and Saturday this coming weekend, the 1st through the 3rd, at a number of venues around East Vancouver, including Redgate, The Toast, Green Auto, which is a relatively new venue, and some others, ending with some good shows on Saturday, including one special show well, in the afternoon at Girls Rock Camp. So lots of good stuff. There's too many bands here really to highlight any, and I'm not personally, I'm not enough of an expert on everything going on in the local scene that I want to pick out any bands for you. What I would recommend you do, if you're interested in local music, obviously if you are a real keen follower, just check out their schedule at musicwaste.ca for more information, see what's going on. I'm just going to pick a couple shows and head on down and see what I discover. We have a fabulous music scene here in Vancouver, and I think any of these shows would be worth the $10 to get in the show, and the pass is now $30. Still pretty altogether a great deal. So check it out this weekend. That's Music Waste, and find out more information at musicwaste.ca. I was here with me in the studio, and we were just talking during that last segment, and I think I was going to come back next week, and we're going to do, she's going to do a little feature on the Japanese musician and artist Zard. Bring us a couple tracks and tell us a bit about her history.
Yeah. So I will talk about my favorite artist.
So look forward to that, a little exposure into Japanese music culture, courtesy of Ayu, and we'll bring that to you on the Monday show next week. Here is Bird Note.
This is Bird Note. I'm Ade Ben Salahuddin, an evolutionary biologist in training. It was about 8 a.m. when I stepped off the bus from my overnight summer job, nearly home and ready to sleep. But a sound made me realize I had one more thing to do. A young American robin, still stuck in the chain-link fence where I'd seen it 14 hours earlier. I don't normally intervene, but I'd told myself that if the bird was still there in the morning, I'd try to help. Donning gloves, I tried to gently pull the fledgling out, careful to not injure its wings. After a few attempts, the bird still wouldn't budge. As I paused to reassess, an older black lady approached from up the street. Understanding the problem, she whipped out a purple handkerchief and in 30 seconds dislodged the robin and passed it to me. The woman explained how she grew up in the rural South and had always wanted to become a veterinarian, but was dissuaded by her family before life took over. She said how happy she was to see me out there, and as the bird flew away with its mother, she remarked in awe, "God wanted us to meet this morning." I left with two things when we parted ways: a fond memory and that purple handkerchief, a torch passed from a generation of black naturalists who never got their chance. This week is Black Birders Week. To learn how to participate, follow the hashtag Black Birders Week on social media and visit birdnote.org.
Thank you. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM. Coming up in about 20 minutes is Democracy Now! Stay tuned for that. First, though, is Looking at Lime.
How can people with Lyme modify their exercises and stay fit? How hard can you push yourself? Make yourself stronger as a person. We're going to dive right into that in this podcast. Maybe even throw a little weight around. My guest on this Can Lyme podcast is Gina Vales, who sweats through Lyme and helps others stay strong. Stick with us. We're going to do some heavy lifting. Gina Vales grew up staying fit, and she knew from a young age that she wanted to be a trainer and a business owner, all the while coaching and leading people. She has a degree in exercise science and founded Gina's Total Fitness in Connecticut. She has an Instagram following of almost 180,000 people. In 2017, Gina was diagnosed with Lyme disease, which changed her life and her outlook on fitness. I'm delighted to welcome her to our podcast. We reached her today in South Windsor, Connecticut. Welcome to the podcast, Gina.
Hi.
I follow you on Instagram. It's so exciting to finally meet you.
Nice to meet you guys as well.
How did you first become involved with Lyme disease?
So I actually was, so I got diagnosed with Lyme disease in 2018, but I was undiagnosed for a year in 2017. And it was pretty much just my story of, you know, getting Lyme disease, and I knew nothing about it then. And just really have educated myself, you know, since, you know, having it and managing it day to day since then.
And how has living with Lyme changed your life physically? Because I know you're an athlete, so I know how much an impact that has on your body.
Yeah, so I've been an athlete my whole life. You know, I've been a very competitive athlete, top athlete. And when I got sick, you know, things started changing. I couldn't train as hard as I wanted to. You know, I couldn't really do high intensity stuff anymore. You know, like it's very hard for me to sweat. So I had to just really adjust my workouts to, you know, more body weight and more flow and lower intensity. So even though I am still an athlete, there's times where I can go a little harder on the good days, but it's just more about movement now. So it's really, I've just really adjusted my workouts a lot. You know, and it took a lot of time, trial and error, you know, especially being an athlete, that's like the hardest part, because you always want to go hard and you want to go hard. But, you know, with all the inflammation in my body, you know, workout is a stressor on the body, which causes inflammation. So I really had to just adjust, and I found a way that works for me.
Yeah, it really sounds like you learned how to listen to your body. It was actually one of my questions, just about, you know, what are your thoughts around fighting versus, you know, listening to your body and resting and healing when you need to do that?
Yeah, so at first, you know, I think this is like always a daily struggle, but then as time goes on, you know, years go on, you just try, you have to accept it. You have to just be grateful for the body that you have and the movement that you can do. So, you know, when I was first diagnosed and I was like, okay, I want to go really hard and, you know, squat, you know, 225 and all this stuff. And, you know, I would try to keep doing it, And I'm like, my body just did not like it. And it was saying, no, 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 no. So I think the hardest part was, you know, accepting it. But once you start accepting it, you know, it changes your like mindset about it. So now, you know, I'm just grateful to have a body that I can move, and, you know, I might not be able to squat on the bar 225 anymore, but you know what, I can squat still, you know, 135 or 105. And it's just being grateful for what you can do now. And it's not that, you know, you're less of an athlete or you're not as strong. You know, I feel stronger than ever in a different way.
Absolutely. I think that's so key, just knowing how to adjust your mindset and being gentle with yourself and finding your new normal and then building upon that.
Absolutely.
Now, I found a really great quote on your Instagram. Stronger than ever, a Lyme warrior will always turn pain into strength. What does that mean to you?
Yeah. So when I was going through, you know, my story, my journey with Lyme, you know, I felt it makes you, you know, not having answers for a while, it makes you feel, you know, very lost and makes you feel like weak, you know, physically, mentally, emotionally, you know, you feel very lost. And, you know, I think, you know, everyone would say, you know, you have Lyme disease, like, don't you feel weaker? Don't you feel worse? And you, honestly, it's all mindset. And I've just really had to change the way I look at it. And I, you know, you just turn all that pain, the physical pain, the emotional pain, the mental pain of, you know, not having answers, to going through the, you know, being bedridden, to being sick, going to 10 specialists, getting every x-ray possible. And you turn all that pain and you turn it into strength, and you find your purpose within that. So I always say, be 1% better every day. Don't try to be 100% better. So yes, I know I have Lyme disease and I live with it, but my Lyme disease doesn't like define who I am. So I just use that to really, you know, all the pain I went through, I just have turned it into purpose and strength. And everyone out there, you know, who's going through something like this, you know, it's hard to see light at the end of the tunnel, But if you do change your mindset and you do just adjust in, daily gratitude, I think is a huge part of that. You can really turn that pain into any type of strength you want. And for me, it's to help other people who are dealing with this, to tell them that they're not alone and that there is light at the end of the tunnel, even if it looks different from, what they thought their life should look like.
Oh, that is just so inspiring. I love that. Thank you for sharing that. It's so important for people to hear.
Absolutely.
Do you have any advice about how people can find their own inner warrior?
Yeah. So, that's just going, I think going through adversity of getting, whether it's, any autoimmune disease, whether it's cancer or Lyme disease, but, going through, the lows, hitting rock bottom, going through all the adversity, it just really, it's about, digging deep. And, a warrior is someone that doesn't, a warrior, I think everyone thinks like, being a warrior is just being strong all the time. And that's not the case. Being a warrior is falling down and feeling low and, being sick and, getting up every day and, giving your best and trying to be 1% better. And I think, that's just, it's within, you have to dive deep in and find that inner warrior in yourself.
Oh, that's so great. Thinking specifically about exercises, how can people modify their exercise routines so they can stay fit?
Yeah, so I guess because I've had it since 2017, so I've done a lot of trial and error, like with weights, without weights, walking, cardio, strength training. And since, Lyme disease, it's inflammation in the body and, all the bacteria, pathogens, viruses, they all want to come out and they, that's what the Lyme disease is. And the whole point of that is to try to hide those guys and manage it because it's not curable. It's going to be in your body. But for me personally, a mix of everything has helped me. So like, I know I can't do super heavy weights anymore. So, it's kind of like, when I wake up that day, it's kind of like, all right, what is my body saying? What does it want? What is it craving? Is it craving a mobility routine to get blood flow, to open up my spine, open up my joints that the Lyme disease is attacking? Or, can I push it a little bit today and, add a little bit of, a little bit of weight, just to build that foundation? Or maybe today is just good for a walk, just to get blood flow, get to, vitamin D. So I don't think there's a set in stone program, but it's more so about listening to your own body and trial and error through different modalities in different programs.
Yeah. And you bring up a great point of just that movement and how important that is, especially for supporting like our lymphatic system and draining those toxins out of our body. We had Angela Naith, she's a triathlete. She was on our podcast earlier this season, and she was talking about how for her, she really needed to cut out some of the more high impact sports. So she said for her as a triathlete, biking and swimming were so much better for her body than, say, running. The high impact really affected her more.
Yeah. So, and that's through her trial and error and just listening to her body. I mean, personally, so like running for me actually, it feels great on my body. So that's just the blood flow, I think, for me personally. Like I still lift, but like if I do a lot of heavy lifting, that's my body really, really kind of shuts down because the central nervous system. So it's for me, it's just honestly like I wake up and I'm like, okay, today is like a good run day, or tomorrow, I need a rest day, So I think the high intensity and then like the high impact, like you said, maybe for her, that has a huge effect on hormones too. And hormones is a huge part of that as well. So, it's finding what works for you. And, I don't think there's, just one fits all, if that makes sense.
Oh yeah. How do you know when you've pushed it too hard?
So for me personally, like if I go too hard, I actually feel it in my body. So I actually feel like my heart rate, maybe I'm having like my heart rate skyrockets and I'm feeling anxiety or, you know, heart palpitations or my joints really hurt. So there's certain things, you know, that I think set it off. When you listen to people though, who have Lyme, like everyone's a little different. So like, you know, there's some people who have Lyme disease who can't tolerate the heat. Personally, the heat works way better for me. I don't do good in cold weather when I'm working out. So, you know, because it is Lyme disease, but remember there's different co-infections with Lyme disease. So everyone's body is different depending on whatever that tick carried. So I think that has a lot to do with it, the co-infections itself.
And are there any considerations for recovery that you've found beneficial?
Yeah. So, I have done, you know, sauna therapy. I have done, red light therapy. I've done cryotherapy. So I've done cold, hot, you know, mitochondria therapy. And cause we want to increase that cellular, level. So again, you know, some people with Lyme disease, just they go into an infrared sauna and maybe it's too much for them at that point, you know? But it's really, you know, just like I said before, everyone's so different, but personally for me, like the sauna has really helped me, with some die off and, you know, cryotherapy has really helped with my inflammation. So that's two extremes right there, cold to hot, you know? And then the red light is awesome just in general too, for, you know, cells and, mood and all that at a cellular, level.
So you and I have both chosen to share our experiences publicly. How does sharing help us?
Yeah, I think, you know, I get this all the time because I'm a very open book, with my story. And yes, I do believe when you share your story, yes, it helps you heal within. So I think sharing my story does help me, but it also it's about connecting with others to make them feel like they're not alone as well. Because as human beings, we need connection. We need networking. We need that. So I think for me sharing my story, you know, I get messages all the time saying, thank you so much for sharing your story. Like, you know, it's helped me every day, like just be a little more positive and all that. And that's like the best feeling in the world, you know, just helping other people and seeing the change and, you know, having them be the change. Because if I help one person, you know, that person can help another person. So I think sharing, you know, your story, and everyone's different. Some people are, you know, I'm more private with a lot of other things in my life, but something like this, you know, it's always felt right. And I just want to help people and, you know, make them believe, you know, to find that inner warrior and to not give up, and that, you know, there is hope.
There sure is. There's a lot of hope.
Yeah. Yeah. And that doesn't mean I have bad days. Like there's going to be a lot of bad days. There's going to be a lot of good days. There's going to be okay days, but that's all part of it. So it's not that you're going to cure yourself. It's more about managing it and, you know, being centered and being, you know, bloom where you're planted with, you know, your journey and your disease.
After all that you've gone through, do you think you've experienced some post-traumatic growth?
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's crazy. So, you know, since 2017, it's been a long road just with Lyme disease. You know, I also have had Epstein-Barr and mono. I also, you know, I own a gym. You know, with COVID, I had COVID, Lyme disease, and mono, Epstein-Barr all together this year.
Oh,
and
God.
Yeah. And owning a gym, you know, gyms, over 6,000 gyms closed this year. And I was trying to still run a gym, you know, and it was a very rock bottom year for me. And right now where I'm at, I'm just, you know, I've grown so much in the past, just the past couple of months, and, you know, I'm launching a brand new brand called Immune, and it's for warriors in general, but it's for, you know, a lot of the Lyme warriors, and, you know, just our immune system. So I got, you know, that name, it just really felt right. And, yeah, I'm really excited to launch that. I can't give the full details yet, but it's going to be, you know, lots of health, nutrition, workouts, and a lot more. And that will be launched May 18th.
Oh, that's fabulous. Well, it sure sounds like you've gone through the challenges, but through it all, it sounds like you've really fortified your spirit and your strength and your mindset. So way to go.
Thank you. Thank you. And you too. You sound great over there. So.
Yeah, thank you. Do you have any closing comments for our listeners and your Instagram community?
Yeah, so I share a lot on Instagram. So I have three handles, but so one of them is Gina Vales Fit. That's more of, I share my Lyme disease story on there. But that's more, you know, I post workouts all the time, daily movement, motivation, inspiration. And then my Gina's Total Fitness is my gym. So I have a gym here in Connecticut. And so if you live around me, you guys are more than welcome to, you know, come stop in, join the community. And then my new handle is Immune Warrior. So, you know, especially on this podcast, all my, you know, warriors out there, autoimmune or Lyme disease, you could give that a follow and engage with us because there's going to be a lot of stuff coming at you. But I guess just closing, you know, is I think your environment and your support system have a lot to do with it. So I know if one of my Instagrams or Facebook pages can, you know, be positive for you, you know, I would love to hear your story and you can shoot me a DM. I would get back to you as soon as I can. And just to, you know, not give up. And I know it's easier said than done, but, every day, I think you just have to wake up and like with living with Lyme disease, like I wake up and the moment I put my feet on the floor, like you don't know how you're going to feel with this disease. So like, pretty much the morning I wake up and I put my feet on the ground, I know if this is going to be a bad day or a good day. But you can always make it, you know, the best day possible with just your mindset. So you can't give up on those bad days. You just have to take the bad days with the good.
Well, you are truly an inspiration, Gina. Thank you so much for giving hope to so many people. And thank you for speaking up about overcoming your challenge.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. And yeah, this was fun.
Gina Vales is a personal trainer from South Windsor, Connecticut. In her words, remember to bloom where you're planted and try to find a way to turn pain into purpose. That's another podcast. I'm your host, Sarah Cormode. Remember to stay safe in the outdoors.
The annual Sled Island Music and Arts Festival is back June 21st to the 25th. Experience 5 days of music, comedy, film, and art in diverse venues across Calgary, Alberta. Featuring genre-defying indie alternative artist Barty Strange as guest curator, garage rock chameleons Osays, Chicago-based indie rock three-piece Dead, Latin folk innovator Helada Negro, Toronto's viral hip-hop sensation Akintoye, gothic folk artist Emma Ruth Rundle, alternative R&B hip-hop artist Amindi, and plus many more. There's 150 artists yet to be announced. Check out the current lineup and get your passes and tickets at sledisland.com.
All right, that brings us to the end of our program for this week. Thanks for tuning in. My name is Magnus Thiebald today, and joining me today is Ayu.
Yeah, I'm Ayu.
Ayu Sakamoto. And Ayu is going to be back next week with a profile on Japanese artist Zard. Coming up in just a few minutes is Democracy Now. That's going to be followed up at 12 noon by Wandering Rhythms, Generic Alternative at 2 p.m. and Typically Tuesdays at 3 p.m. All that coming up and more on CJSF today. We're going to finish off with a little bit of a selection from Zard, just to play us out at the end of the hour. And as I say, check us out next week when Ayu is going to be bringing us a feature on this artist so you can learn a little bit more about Zard. Yes. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you.